Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 457 at Midnight Returns, January 6th, the Comedy Central. Midnight, every night, following the Colbert Report and the Daily Show. Well, Daily Show. Colbert follows Daily Show. At Midnight follows Colbert. You know how it works, because those other two shows have been on for buttloads of time. We're a baby show. We're a brand new baby. Tune in on January 6th to smack the naked behind of At Midnight on Comedy Central. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by The Spoils of Babylon, coming to IFC. So, I don't know if you know Eric Jonrosch or not. Hugely talented author. I've been trying to get this guy on the show. He's impossible to pin down, but I'm just such a huge, huge, huge fan. Author of 57 best-selling novels, including The Spoils of Galaxy 7, The Spoils of Grasping for God, The Spoils of the Sahara, The Spoils of the Singing Night Squirrel, The Spoils of the Weeping Falcon, The Spoils Beneath the Sea. I mean, you know the work, you've probably read the work, and we will get him on someday. But until then, you will actually be able to see Eric Jonrosch on the tiny small screen in the upcoming epic miniseries, The Spoils of Babylon, coming to IFC Thursday, January 9th, 10, 9 Central. Also starring in The Spoils of Babylon, this epic, epic television event, Kristen Wiig, Tobey Maguire, Will Ferrell, Jessica Alba, Val Kilmer, Haley Joel Osment, Tim Robbins, Michael Sheen. Come on! How many more names, any one of those names, should draw you to a television event like The Spoils of Babylon on IFC, Thursday, January 9th, 10, 9 Central? The premiere night will include two back-to-back episodes. Gorge yourself on the spoils of television about The Spoils of Babylon on IFC. To learn more, visit thespoilsofbabylon.com. This episode of the podcast is Moby, who I'll tell the story on the podcast about how I first discovered Moby in the early 90s when my roommate and I went through a rave phase. Well, I sort of just told the story, but there's more details and it's more colorful and fun, and then he responds, not just me talking in the intro. But Moby and I became pals after this podcast. What a terrific guy. So his album is called The Innocents, his most recent album. That is available wherever you get albums. Digital albums. I got it on the iTunes. He probably would have given it to me, but I like supporting people. So I got it myself on the internet tunes. So here we go. And there's podcast number 457 with Moby.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I tried Cloaca as a nickname. My girlfriend's name is Chloe. Mm-hmm. And I tried Cloaca as a nickname once. It didn't fly.
Like mine, I like Clozone.
Clozone's pretty good.
Yeah.
Clojo.
Maybe I'll call her Chloe from now on. I'll just smash it.
That rhymes with
Moby, who's sitting before us.
Hi.
Welcome.
So we're talking about confusing people's names?
Yes.
Okay, so here's... I do that quite a lot. I think I have some weird form of almost like name dyslexia.
Okay.
The worst, and it hurts me to even think about it. I was on tour, and it was the last show of a tour, and so all of my friends were there, and family members, and record company, and management, so about 30 people backstage, and my new girlfriend came, and I stopped, and I said, everybody, meet Christy, and I was like, hi, and there was this pause, and she said, my name's Katie.
Oh!
And it was so... It wasn't just that I had confused her name with someone, with the name of my ex-girlfriend.
Oh.
But in front... That I'd stopped everyone that I'd... So in front of 30 or 40 people. Yeah, it was... Yep.
How did you recover from that?
And this makes me think that there's a word that's missing from the English language when you're so uncomfortable that, like, your organs clench up.
Sure.
You know, like, it's almost like your spleen starts to, like, get small and atrophied.
I think it's called spleenasma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's because I'm looking at you guys right now and you're having that vicarious experience. Like you're
because that is one of those showing up to class with no clothes on type of nightmares or, hey, you're about to perform on a show, but you don't know what the set list is and everyone's looking at you. That is really one of those nightmarish moments. Jonah asked, but how did you recover from that?
I recovered this. Well, I stopped drinking about 5 years ago, but this was back when I drank. And I think I recovered by blaming alcohol, like by saying like, oh, I was kind of drunk. And then I recovered by just drinking more.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And so then, like, it was like, you know, sort of to paraphrase Homer Simpson, it was like the cause and the solution to my problem.
And then, of course, you have to ply her with some alcohol so that it takes the edge off and then everything's fine.
Did you call me ex-girlfriend's name? No, you were pretty wasted last night, though. You were hearing stuff.
You said that I did that, but I never did that. You were really hammered.
Yeah, you were really far.
It is because I've been sober for 10 years, and it is that kind of interesting to have to just take responsibility for everything you do, you know, which I kind of like, but at the same time I had forgotten, oh yeah, there was a time where you could just throw that in the booze bin and go, oh, that was alcohol. Yeah.
And I still have a lot of things in the booze bin, meaning I will encounter people, like I'll be out and someone will come up to me saying like, oh, hey, really nice to see you again. It's like, I don't know who you are. Mm-hmm. And it's not even like self-involved narcissistic public figure stuff. It's literally that like bits of my brain have been scooped out by liquor.
Oh, man.
And they're just gone. So like, and people try and like refresh my memory and say, oh, I was at your apartment like 10 years ago. We had this crazy party and we were up until 8 o'clock in the morning. I was like, I did that a lot. And I just don't remember.
Eesh.
So.
Well, the first time that I had ever heard of you was in like 91 or 2. My roommate and I, a young actor by the name of Will Wheaton, and I were obsessed with going to raves. We were obsessed.
Will Wheaton?
Yeah.
As in Next Gen?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that guy. So Will. Hmm. So Will and I were these young rave teens who would go to warehouse raves. Will became obsessed with DJing. Obsessed. And he... fortunately or unfortunately, had the disposable income to just buy a bunch of DJ equipment. Mm-hmm. And so the first time that I still love the song, and I don't know if you remember it, but I think it was just called Ah.
Oh, there was one song called Ah, Ah.
Ah, Ah, yeah. And it was just this really...
That's pretty much the gist of it. Yeah. That's the whole song. Yeah.
And then a voice came in, which may have been yours, just going, Ah.
I actually don't know who... the voice was, because back in those days, and even now to an extent, I would just sample a bunch of things and never write down the names of what I sampled. And so, because it's this sort of the ethos of asking for forgiveness rather than permission.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's been my approach in sampling, like just sample a whole bunch of stuff. And if you get sued, well, that's okay. It means you got caught.
The odd guy's going to be like, that was my voice. I did not approve.
And it has happened, like, on the album that I made called Play, there's a song called Porcelain.
Yes.
And I had a really obscure sample, like a painfully obscure sample from an old soundtrack from the 60s. And I sampled it, pitched it down, and played it backwards. And it turns out there is a guy in England who's like a train spotter for samples. His hobby... and I want to find this person and kill him. His hobby is listening to records, finding obscure samples, finding them, and contacting the record company.
Wow.
So literally, he contacted the record company, and the record company then sued me. And the record company actually admitted to me, they're like, there's no way we would have ever found this. They're like, we didn't
even... Does he get a cut? Like a
he doesn't get
fee?
A cut. It's just, it's his public service. And that's his hobby, and that's what he does.
Sort of like the Wikipedia editors, where they just they want to do for the humanity.
And in this case, like, it was so obscure, and just like the fact that it would have like languished in obscurity had he not taken it upon himself to find it.
Was it in the final version of Porcelain, or did you have to cut it?
It's the string sample. Like, it
Oh, yeah, it's reverse. Yeah.
Played
yeah.
backwards, pitch down from an obscure. So. That still hurts.
How the fuck did that guy figure that out?
At the same time, I mean, what am I complaining? I'm basically complaining about the fact that I stole something and got caught.
And then get away with it.
You know, so, like, I have nothing to complain
about. On an album that sold, like, 8 million copies.
Yeah. So, I'm not complaining. I'm just annoyed.
But I can understand that. So, my sort of empathy with you with this sort of the... the throwing things into the booze bin is I remember very specifically that culture was very much about just raw feeling good things where it was just, you know, the people.
It's called ecstasy, Chris.
I know people. Well, I never did ecstasy, but I
really?
I just got really drunk. Yeah, no, I was terrified of doing drugs. And so I but you'd get really drunk, but then you would just see people fucking hanging onto these massive speakers doing incalculable ear damage, but it just. Like it was just like their molecules were just – they could just feel all their molecules vibrating.
Yep. The funny thing is during that period, I was sober. So I had like 8 years sobriety followed by about 13 years non-sobriety. So like the height of the rave period, like 90, 91, 92, 93, I was completely sober. So I remember everything from
then. Were you still just straight edge from being
– when I was a very confused straight edge.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, I was a straight edge punk rocker, but I also drank a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, meaning I would go to see Minor Threat and put the X on the back of my hand and then after the show go out and get drunk.
Best of both worlds, it seems.
Yeah, I was like, this seems consistent to
me. Why does
like,
no one do this?
Like, I'm at the Minor Threat show and I'm not drinking and then I would go out afterwards and get drunk.
Yeah, so you seem cool to the kids at the show.
Yeah.
And then you go and hang out with the actual cool kids.
It seems completely consistent. Yeah. But then, so I'd stopped drinking for about 8 years and that was during that rave scene that you and Will Wheaton were a part of.
Yes.
And but the joy that you're describing, that is, like, it is kind of fascinating because you're right, that was the defining ethos of that scene was simply joy. It almost wasn't even hedonistic. Like, it wasn't like you think of, like, the hair metal scene and it was, like, maybe celebratory, but it was all about, like, sex and drugs excess. And whatever and, like, the rave scene was just about joy.
Yeah.
And I never really thought of it that way.
Yeah, just a bunch of people basically descend on a warehouse and they put giant speakers and bring you or like DJ Dan or someone and then you guys and then you would just stand there and just
feel it.
Just, to make another Star Trek reference, it was like getting caught in the ribbon of the Nexus basically where you were just completely it was just completely pleasurable.
You should have tried ecstasy then, because
I wouldn't have been able to handle it.
You could just get.
I don't have the brain for drugs. I don't have the brain for it. I would have fucking the first 2 minutes that I would have started to feel something weird happening with my body that I couldn't identify. I would have fucking torn my skin off.
See, there's a way of dealing with that, and I'm not suggesting that you try ecstasy. See, and I'm not advocating ecstasy use, but if you combine it with alcohol,
See
what the liquor because what the alcohol does, it sort of like. I don't know, attenuates the anxiety. And then the ecstasy kicks in, and it's the greatest feeling I've ever had in my entire life.
It's the fucking best. It's so good.
Like
everything is great.
I remember one day after doing a lot of ecstasy, not that terrible ecstasy hangover.
They call them e-holes or something like that?
Day where like everything's gray and hurts.
Yeah, it's not fun.
And you can't remember anything like literally you're out you're having brunch and you're like reaching for a fork and you're like I know that's metal I don't know what it's called and I remember thinking to myself like if there and I have a weird spiritual life but I just remember thinking like if there's a truly benign God why don't we feel like we're on ecstasy from the time we're born until the time we die
yeah. Because it's that good
like an omniscient all-powerful God couldn't God just create us with a neurochemistry where we're always in a state of joy. And people are like, oh, but then you'd never make art. I was like, so what? You
know, like you'd I'd be happy all
you'd
the
be
time.
Happy.
Yeah. So you wouldn't need art.
Yeah.
No one would need art or stimulation.
Yeah, you wouldn't have to express anything and try to figure shit out because you would just have it all figured out and it would be everything would be awesome all the time.
Yeah, I remember the kids I knew that like I was a straight edge kid and like you know the rave kids I knew in high school would take an ecstasy and I hate it. Like it, you know, and maybe I said like I don't want to listen to a type of music that's so closely associated. And I also hated reggae because I was just like reggae is weed. You know, the electronic music is ecstasy, and it made me resent all that stuff. And it wasn't until I was in my 20s where I was like, well, let's see what the hubbub is all about. And then I was like, fucking hey, they had it. I was wrong. I was the guy. I was straight edge and listened to punk, and I was bored and I had nothing to do. So I would tip over porta potties or make you know fucking messes or graffiti.
Well, I too have spent a lot of my life being wrong in that way.
Yeah,
like I decided at one point that I hated Prince. This is like, but this is a long time. This is like the mid 80s. And I was like, oh, Prince, and it's too mainstream. And then I had a girlfriend who loved Prince, and she got me to watch Purple Rain. And I was like, this is great.
Yes.
Like, why am I being such a douchebag? Like, yeah. Why have I decided preemptively that I don't like stuff? Like, what? It's almost like this hierarchy of joy, like the joy of hating things, for me, I thought was so much greater than the joy of liking mainstream things. And then I just realized, like, Terminator 2, Star Trek Next Generation, Prince, things that, like, I had rejected because they were too mainstream.
Yeah.
But they're great.
That's the worst side effect of punk, and I've said that before. Yeah. It's like, that's the thing when, like, punk, you go, no, it has to be this way, and if it's not this way, it sucks. If it's on the radio, and do you like the song? Yeah, I love it. It's on the radio. Never mind, it fucking blows.
Yeah.
You know, that's a weird
thing. Friends and I started, because we all grew up in the hardcore scene, and we started a fake hardcore band called the Pork Guys, and we had a song called 7-Inch Sellout. the premise being that if you've made a 7-inch, you've sold out.
Yeah, to even like go as far to record something.
Yeah,
the least amount of work you can do.
Yeah,
that a 7-inch at that time was probably cheaper than a tape.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the idea of you want to be special, or you want to feel special, and if you have something in common with the lowest common denominator, then that makes you one of the lowest common denominator, and you are therefore not special anymore, and so you can't.
Yeah,
I think as you start to get older, you're just gonna go, hey, who fucking gives a shit? You know, like, I like what I like. Some things are mainstream, some things aren't mainstream. I just like what I. Then you get more comfortable. I think getting more comfortable with yourself dissipates a lot of that.
Yes, because you don't need a thing to have an identity anymore. Like, that's what I thought about Straight Edge when I was a kid. I was like, mm-hmm. Well, it gives me a thing. I can say I am.
Oh, I've had lots of things.
Yeah.
I was a vegan, am a vegan. I was an atheist, and I was a Christian. Punk rocker, then a raver. So I've always had a thing.
Yeah.
And then over time, you sort of ask yourself, like, why are these things so important to me? Like, why is it so important that I belong to this exclusionary cult?
Yeah.
You know, why do I go hang out with my, like, straight-edge vegan friends and judge everyone else? And then you look at everyone else, and they're actually having a good time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I have a theory on that, which is that I think we do it as... I think we like to have like a prefab belief system because it just makes dealing with life easier because mm-hmm. you can go rather than we just don't have the energy to process, especially with as much data as we were processing at all times now, to every single situation. Well, I'm going to weigh all the options and I'm going to see this. And then it's just to have a go, well, I believe this. So this probably falls into this.
And if you think of it from an evolutionary perspective, like it's like we have, billion, or let's say 450 million years of sort of compartmentalization being rewarded. Like, I sometimes think, let's go back 500,000 years ago and some proto-humans are on the plains of the Serengeti, and there's one proto-human who's capable of compartmentalizing, another human being isn't. The one proto-human looks at a lion and says, that's a lion, run away from it. And the other proto-human says, actually, it's a very complex being, and there's subtlety and nuance to it, and to just reduce it to saying that it's a lion is really doing it a disservice. At that point, that person gets eaten, and their genetic line ends, whereas the person who compartmentalizes runs away to have sex and make babies, so you end up with us, who are just, like, hardwired to compartmentalize.
Yeah.
Well, we have to, also because I think that... you know, the layering of our brain is there's a very primitive part of the brain and then there's a higher part of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them has to process things that it doesn't quite understand. And so that's where
this is – because normally you guys like for guests to try and be funny, right?
No. We just talk.
Oh, it's anything
you want.
Yeah, because brain architecture is one of my – I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, in a very, very general sense, and I don't want to be pedantic, but you are describing there's like the lizard brain.
Yes.
Which is that automatic response.
Like the limbic system.
Yeah.
The limbic system is actually on top of the lizard brain.
So
the limbic system is more what governs emotion. So the way you can think of it is like the lizard brain, which is every species has it. Like, mm-hmm. you know, crocodiles have a lizard brain. We have a lizard brain. Then on top of that is the limbic system, which is like us and other mammals, which is what sort of bonds us to other mammals or other people, ideally. And then on top of that would be like the prefrontal cortex, which is the executive function. And the funny thing is sort of like the amygdala, the core brain, the lizard brain is the one that has that immediate response. But it can actually take signals from the executive function. You know, so like if you want to stab someone and then like your immediate response is, I want to stab this person. And the executive function says, you know what? Perhaps you shouldn't. You know, and then the limbic system says, let's just be friends with them.
Yeah. So what is it that fascinates you so much about the, I mean, what do you want to do with this information? Like what, or is it just like a hobby?
To have a, I mean, not to sound too much like a self-involved New Age Southern California resident, but to just have a better understanding of who we are and not to be as ruled by our sort of like automatic cognitions as we oftentimes are,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because again, I'm stating the obvious, but everything is in our brains. Like nothing exists outside of our cognition. You know, and we tend to give the rest of the world so much credit, like saying like there is this physical world out there and it has so much power and so many inherent characteristics, and it just doesn't. Like everything is cognition.
Because essentially everything is, our realities are defined by our perceptions.
Yeah. And all we have is our like really flawed, weird sense organs that are kind of amazing, like sight and sense, touch, etc. But everything ultimately resides in our little brains. And so it seems like there's no better study than trying to understand what our brains actually do.
And what have you learned so far?
Oh, so
I was a philosophy major, by the
me
way.
Me too. Yeah.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Where'd you go to school?
Well, I went to UConn and then SUNY Purchase, University of New York at Purchase. I never quite graduated.
Yeah, I was close, and then I left school to go work for MTV. But
I didn't even go to school, so.
Good for you.
Yeah.
But there is, I mean, because what we're talking about is sort of like, you know when Descartes said, cogito ergo sum? Like,
yes.
I think therefore I am. Mm-hmm. What had led him to do that is he had doubted everything. You know, like he was like, I don't trust my sense perception, you know, like, because, and so I don't have any objective understanding of the world. And then at the end of it, the only thing he said he couldn't doubt was that he was doubting. So it's like, I think therefore I am, meaning like, therefore if I'm thinking, there must be an existence here.
Right.
And then he extrapolated and he said, well, if there's a benign God, God wouldn't lie to me. So clearly the world is as it seems to be, which is kind of a stretch.
You know? And then he also said, if there was a benign God, we would just feel like we were doing ecstasy all the time.
Yeah. And then, as you know, then of course, along came the existentialists who said Descartes was wrong. We can think beyond that. We have no knowledge of anything. You know, everything we perceive is a distortion. And to an extent, that's true. And then the question becomes, what do you do with that knowledge? Like if we understand that all of our perception is distorted and the universe bears no, our perception of the universe bears no relation to what it actually is, do we kill ourselves? Do we just get drunk? Or do we just sort of say, oh, that's part of the human condition, is having no objective understanding of what the universe might actually be?
I like that option.
Yeah.
I like that option a lot. But isn't it fascinating that essentially, we're 6 billion distorted perceptions, but we can still somehow cluster together to find common ground. I mean, you know, it's like the that kind of thing of like, well, how do I know that this is a table that you're seeing and this is a table that I'm seeing? But we both somehow agree that this is a table and that it's, of some earth tone.
It's like naive subjectivism.
It is. That we basically form these basic unspoken agreements with each other that we all agree that the world is generally this kind of thing. But I still don't know what you perceive it as.
Yeah. And whether, I mean, none of you might actually exist.
Oh, God, that'd be a relief.
That's called solipsism.
Yeah.
If you're saying that we don't, like, if
it's
one.
It's possible.
It's possible. Yeah.
So this is what I spend most of my time thinking about, for better or worse. It does sort of drive you crazy after a while.
Well, yeah, because there's no – it really is – you know, the pursuit of philosophy is really the – I feel like the – like a cognitive process. It's – there's no – there's not going to be a, aha, it's this, you know. It really is just about the process.
Can that get you really – like do those roads lead towards just being a nihilist? If when you get
they
to
can.
A place where you just go, well, if no one's really sure what everyone else is doing and we're not, none of us are sure what exists and what doesn't, then nothing will matter. And therefore,
that's what he was saying before, like one of the three options.
Or you just defer back to this like naive subjectivism, which is like, say like, oh, I understand that ice cream doesn't technically have any fixed identity as ice cream, but it still tastes nice.
Yeah.
You know, like I might look at my flat screen TV and say like, wow, there's, let's say, a few hundred million pixels there, each one doing something weird that I don't understand, but still I like watching Family Guy.
So, but, so everything is nothing, but nothing is all we have.
Yeah, and might as well just sort of enjoy it while we're here and, like, at the very least, almost like take like a sort of quasi-Hippocratic oath, or just say, like, just do no harm, try and be nice to people, and also, like, recognizing that it seems like all humans, we're all sort of in the same boat in that we don't know what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, and we're all confused, we're all baffled, so why not just sort of, like, be nice to other humans in the process? Because there's a good chance the other humans are actually a little more confused than you are.
Yeah.
So as someone who said that, you know, you said you've tried a bunch of different identities and, you know, atheist and Christian, and you referred to being, like, you said you had this weird spirituality. Was there something, did you find something in any of that which helped kind give it meaning? Is that what you meant by weird spirituality?
Yeah, I guess it's, it's a really good question, and I'm distracted by the painting behind you, the superhero painting.
Yes.
I know that podcasts are a visual medium. There's a painting.
It just assumed of, we look that buff, and I'm going to let them keep on assuming.
It's like, do you know Jake Fogelnest?
Of course, yeah. Very well. Jake's great. Yeah.
So Jake's an old friend of mine, and so he tweeted the other day something about, he was like, do the majority of you people know that I'm like 5'5" and really skinny and like, so that, yeah, like public perception. So he needs a superhero icon avatar like you guys. Yeah.
To put on the SiriusXM homepage.
Yeah, yeah, so it was funny. There was a picture he tweeted, I think, of just us standing next to each other, and then people were just responding with like, I don't know if Jake's really tiny or Jonah's insanely huge.
Yeah. Both are true.
Yes, exactly. So it's just an odd side by side.
So going back to your question, basically it's looking at like all these choices, like straight edge, vegan, punk rock, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The question becomes not have I made a good choice, but what led me to make the choice? You know, we were sort of talking about that earlier.
Yeah.
And that's to me a much more interesting question than like analyzing the choice itself, but saying like what compels me to make that choice? You know, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
Like where is it really coming from? And usually, at least in my case, and I think in a lot of people's cases, are sort of like controlling choices. They all come from a place of insecurity and fear.
Sure.
You know, like if I can make the right choice, suddenly everything will make sense and the world will be better and I won't feel like shit. You know.
That's really interesting to hear you describe it that way, because it's essentially, I don't know, for some reason I immediately likened it to astrophysics, and it's like, well, you know, we can't see necessarily that there is a, you know, a star with orbiting planets, but they measure the wobble.
Yeah.
They essentially are measuring the effect that those things have, and then they deduce, well, that body, that must be there, because otherwise why would this be happening as an effect?
Yep.
So that's kind of an interesting way to, I'd never thought about doing that way, because I think we're so result-oriented that asking like, well, why do I do this, or how did I get here? I think those are questions a lot of people don't normally ask.
Yeah. Well, so sort of to that end, I had a rule, not a rule, but a sort of a practice with my ex-girlfriend. Whenever we argued, I gave her these two questions that immediately ended any argument. And all she had to do was ask me these questions. And sometimes it drove me crazy. All she had to do is say, like, what's your role in it and what's really going on? And I was like, ugh, because I want it to be her fault. I want to blame something. And I was like, the truth is, those are the only valid questions I could ever ask myself. Like, what's my role in it and what's actually going on?
Yeah.
You know, and usually, like, if I'm, like, not to sound like a Southern California New Age crazy person, but, like, there's almost, like, there's the hard emotions of, like, anger, defensiveness, bitterness, etc. And then underneath it, if I'm willing to look at it, it's sort of like slightly more vulnerable emotions of like fear, insecurity. But like the angry emotions are so much more seductive.
Well, they're also the protective guard dog.
Yeah.
Because the gushy stuff down here can hurt.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, I'm not great at it, but I have a version of that, which is in the midst of a fight, if you go, well, what's my goal?
Yeah.
Because at a certain point, you just fight to fight. Just weird biological, which I'm sure goes back to, you know, lizard brainstem physiology. But But and then when you go, what's my goal here? Is my goal really to obliterate this other person with words?
Mm-hmm.
Or is my goal to get along and try to figure it out and gain an understanding? And then when you start getting like upper level brained about it, then you like start to feel that other stuff kind of deflate. And go, yeah, my goal is not to hurt this person's feelings because I care about them.
Well, when I'm arguing, my goal is to hurt the other person's feelings, and I want them to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that they're wrong and I'm right, and I want them to sort of like bow down in humility to my supreme rightness. And then at the end of it, I don't have any friends.
Right. You know. You also shouldn't go on the internet.
Yeah. So that's one thing I had to like, why is it so important? Like, if you're talking about like the transparency of the International Monetary Fund with someone and you have like a pro con, like who cares?
Right.
Like, why am I arguing it? Like, I'm like fighting as if I'm like fighting to get insulin for my sick child or something. And like, I'm defending my position. Like, at the end of the day, who cares? Like, even if it's a really important opinion, like, it's just an opinion. It's just words and thoughts. And unless you're, I don't know, holding office in some legislative body, there's a good chance that our opinions and thoughts don't really matter that much.
No. Well, I feel
so,
like
so much so that we're willing to like sacrifice friendship, health, well-being to prove the primacy of our ideas.
Well, yeah, there is the sort of biological thing that we will argue to protect our points even in the face of evidence that what we believe is false.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, I guess it's just that it's sort of that similar idea of like, I, you know, that goes along with compartmentalizing things of like, no, I'm standing my ground so that I can make sure that my genes survive or something. Yep. And so we will argue even at a certain point when in the back of our head we go, I'll go, oh, she's kind of got you on that point. I don't care. You know, like you still. Yeah,
I almost like to have in my brain a laundry list of the stupidest arguments I've ever had. One of my best was with an ex-girlfriend. It was about 20-some-odd years ago. We had this huge argument, and it almost led us to break up. And the argument was whether people would be happier living underground or above ground. That was that. Yeah. Literally, for about 90 minutes, both of us furious at each other. My point of view was that people would be happier living underground because above ground would then be nature. And she was like, yeah, but then people would be living underground and they'd be very unhappy. I was like, yeah, but then they'd have instead of having like urban environments above ground, you'd have the urban environment underground and nature above ground. Neither one of us was right. She was actually way more right than I was because clearly people don't want to live underground.
That's right, because we don't.
But I was convinced, like, I mean, like we were literally on the edge of breaking up because we disagreed with each other so much.
Do you think that underscored a much deeper issue in the relationship, or was that an isolated incident?
I think it underscored a much deeper issue with me, is that like deep down I'm kind of an asshole. and I can't see that I'm wrong even when I'm wrong.
But at least you know that, though.
But luckily, I've been wrong so many times that now it's really hard for me to ever think that I'm right.
Oh, right.
I think of all those times. Or even like, again, what you're saying, like, even when I've been right, it's like, to what end?
Right.
Like, who? Like, so you're right and you lose a friend. Or so you're right and you end a relationship. Like, I'd rather be wrong and have friends and good relationships than be right and sit alone by myself on my mid-century couch, you know.
What I imagine is a very nice view of the city.
I've got a nice view of the city, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I saw, did you do something in a magazine or something? It was like you gave a tour of your house. It was,
New York Times.
Was it New York Times?
Yeah.
Really lovely.
Thanks.
Was it really sort of important for you to, because that's what in Los Angeles, finding a place, because everything's just so fucking crowded,
mm-hmm.
but there are places where you can find a little bit of peaceful, but still feel connected to the city.
Well, how long have you guys lived here?
25 years.
I've been here 12 years.
Okay, because I've been here about 3 years, and I'm still trying to figure it out. Like, I've been here hundreds of times for work, but the experience of living here really is unlike living in any other city in the world. The vastness, the sprawl, and just the weirdness. Like, there's absolutely no cohesion here.
No, there's no identity, and there's no center.
Yeah.
It's just out
there.
That's,
you know, because
but you know, Honolulu is a lot like that, which is, you know, where I grew up. So it's like it's a very similar city where it just kind of just keeps going, and then like there's no separation between, well, you're in this town now, but where's that other town? Well, it's just that starts across the street.
Yeah,
and it doesn't look like there's any different. I find that it's like in any city you can do that to Manhattan too, where it's, you know, everyone's like, oh, you live in Manhattan, but like Manhattan is only really, the people who live there and work there are relegated to their own little neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
and there's no big difference from like the East Village to the West. Yeah, you know, there is. But not to a blind
I'm
eye.
I'm dumb. Someone just explained to me what Tribeca meant.
Oh, there's some good acronyms.
Yeah. Do you know what it means?
No.
Triangle below canal.
The triangle below canal. Because it's all shit's the tip of the island. So I fucking had no idea.
Dumbo? Yep.
Down under the Manhattan Bridge overpass.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. I was born in New York.
So you know all the acronyms.
Yeah. But I love Los Angeles because it's just, you know, it's if you just take, you know, the idea of New York where it's just like it's all a bunch of mashed together neighborhoods, but mm-hmm. just, you know, smash it down and spread it out. And it's the same thing. Instead of apartment buildings, each apartment is a house, and then it just kind of spreads it out.
And that is one of the wonderful things is that, like, in almost any other big city, when people meet up to be social, they meet up in public, because they all, like in New York, like everyone lives in tiny, tiny little apartments that are like far flung and not near each other. Whereas here, people, you live in a house.
Yeah.
And so like when you socialize, you go to someone's house and like you sit in the backyard and you pet the dog, and there's something kind of like sort of like humble and endearing about that.
It's basically, it's, you can live the suburban life in a city in Los Angeles. You could, the idea of the, you know, the suburbs used to be, oh, you get out of this, you're so far away from the city, everyone's just hanging out in their houses and off the interstate. But this is, you're still in the middle of a city. You can hang out in that house and go, oh, it's time to go somewhere. And you're right there.
Yep.
Yeah. I love Los Angeles. I'm a big fan of it.
It is so baffling. And also, I mean, like if I look at it objectively, and it's one of the reasons I moved here, and I'm just saying objectively, insofar as I can be objective, it's a city that's warm in the winter, that's primarily filled with weird artists, writers, musicians, and comedians, with tons of nature and some of the most disparate, interesting architecture on the planet.
Yeah.
Like, it's sort of, objectively speaking, it's paradise. But it's also a weird dystopian place where it takes 2 hours to get from one end of the city to the other. And
but that's only if you're, I mean, it takes a long time to go from one side of New York to the other. Depends on where you're going. You know, I think of LA as the largest artistic community in the world.
Because, and almost, you know, in history.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that there's
everybody
ever
moves here. Everybody, like not everybody, but
just in the sheer vastness of it.
Yeah. It's a, you know, you just, if you're on, you know, this side of the Mississippi and you are a kid in a town that does screen printing or art or comedy or, you know, and you want to do this, is everyone just kind of moves here? Like, oh my, I have friends that just do all kinds of different artistic endeavors, and it's, you know, they're all from different towns.
Yep. And everyone ends up here, and people have the space, especially because as other cities become so prohibitively expensive, I feel like people move here and they can still have, like, artists can still have studios.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I mean, a store like this in New York, this couldn't exist, really.
No.
Like
No. Meltdown? Yeah, no. Meltdown's, it's too big.
I mean,
It would be tight and vertical.
Yeah.
It'd be like three floors.
Yeah. If it even existed, I mean, like, instead this would be like a Bank of America ATM center and a nail salon, and
there'd be a Starbucks the next door.
Yeah, was it Forbidden Planet? It's like the biggest comic book store in New York, right?
And I believe it's gone.
Oh. St. Mark's still around?
Midtown Comics is still there.
I know that there are still a few comic places, but I know that, like, slowly over time, all the interesting things in Manhattan are disappearing.
Well, Patton Oswalt had made this interesting point about Los Angeles where he's like, LA is not a beautiful city. When people say, you know, it's really beautiful here, they're looking at the sky because it's always blue. But when you actually look at most of the buildings in Los Angeles, they're really ugly because LA grew so fast.
Yeah.
In a very short period of time in the 60s, 70s, you know, that a lot is just, it's just a lot of like gross stucco buildings in most of the city.
Yeah. It's like there was enough financial incentive to cut down trees and build something.
Yeah.
But there wasn't enough financial incentive to build anything really nice.
No, yeah. or plan it. It was like, just fucking build that way. Put that over there. I don't give a shit.
And that's the thing. That's what Hawaii is very similar. When, like, you know, when it was gearing up to be a state, you know, everyone just, the idea that it would become part of the union would be so many more regulations. And so I lived in a few apartment buildings that were just these three-story, made out of cinder blocks and wood. That's like most of the apartment buildings in Hawaii. It's just, it was the same thing out here. Just like, get it up, hurry up. You know, just get it
done. Some people say, like, oh, it's, you know, it's Honolulu's beautiful. They're like, oh, because you got the water and the sky and the mountains. Yeah.
But I, you know, Los Angeles, I think is very pretty. And yeah, anytime you just look at one thing, it's never going to be, you know.
There are pockets that are really pretty. You'll find a street where you're like, oh, all these gorgeous craftsman houses that were built in the 20s.
But even like right around here, it's sort of, because I maybe I shouldn't admit this in public, but I have an architecture blog.
That's amazing. That's
awesome. I think it's called Los Angeles Architecture. I'm not sure. I drive around and take pictures of buildings.
Yeah.
Not just like the beautiful buildings, but like the ugly buildings, the random buildings.
Like the Bauhaus KFC on Western.
I don't think I know the Bauhaus KFC. I need to go find. I mean, Western, that whole area, like Western, Beverly, and going east on Beverly, there's so much random stuff there.
Yeah, you got historic Filipino town and Bangladesh.
And then Koreatown is smashed near there.
Koreatown has got a lot of great buildings. Amazing. A lot of gorgeous buildings.
And what's weird is that we're sitting like Sunset Boulevard where we are. It's not that attractive. It should be because it's called Sunset. Like Sunset's beautiful, but like it's dumpy. Literally 50 feet in either direction are beautiful houses.
Yes.
Like how that exists, like in most every other place in the world, there's cohesion where like if there are beautiful houses that sell for millions of dollars, usually what's adjacent to it is pretty nice. Whereas here, like literally if you go 100 feet that way, you'd have to spend $1 million to buy a house. And then you walk down to Sunset and you can go to the fetish collection across the street.
Well, know? Because like, I think, you know, this might encapsulate what the underlying theme of Los Angeles is, which is, you know, probably relatively self-centered. But there are houses on 50 feet either side of Sunset Boulevard. This was probably a really nice street with trees. And at some point, someone was like, I need to put something there. Fuck that. And they just put it up and didn't really think about it. When we were going through LAX the other night, I realized for the first time that LAX is the perfect airport to represent Los Angeles because it is the worst airport in the country.
It's certainly the worst and most baffling big airport. But I apologize for interrupting.
No, please do.
By the way, what I used to say was I don't mean to interrupt, but then I realized if I'm interrupting, why am I saying I don't mean to interrupt? So now I just try to say.
No, that's fine. Please interrupt. Please.
But there is, because I spend a lot of time in LAX.
Yeah.
There's something sort of like functional and provincial about it. You know, the fact that you can drive to your little terminal, and none of the terminals are very nice, nor do they work very well. But after a while, there's like, it's kind of endearing. Like it just, like it's sort of, like I'm trying to think of like a good slogan that would fit like LA and LAX. It's kind of like, it's okay. You know, like,
hey, it gets the job done.
Yeah, like, ish. Like we're trying.
Yeah,
sort of.
We didn't have a lot
sometimes.
Of time.
Yeah,
but
we put up that old cool watchtower. That's about it.
But the reason that I think it represents Los Angeles is because it's an airport that at one time probably made sense when there were less people and there was it's a very simple U-shaped design and you know, but then they just sort of built around it and didn't go, maybe we should figure out a way to tie all this together and have an easy way to get between the terminals. And so to me, it just represents Los Angeles of like, just start building in that direction. Oh, the valley. Yeah, there's tons of room there. Just fucking put up a bunch of shit there and we'll figure it out. You know what it is? That's what it is. Los Angeles, the slogan, and LAX is, we'll figure it out later.
Yeah.
But they never figure it out.
And I think in the back of everyone's mind is this understanding that like nature's not going to let stuff stay around too long. You know, like whenever you're building something, like, it's probably going to fall down in an earthquake.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, it'll burn down. Yeah. Don't worry about it.
We'll deal with it on the
get a good 50 years out of it.
The next go around.
We'll build this shitty building, but when we make it big in this town, we're going to get a nicer building.
Now, I actually flew across the aisle from you once on a Virgin America flight. And I, because I travel so much, I had my own rituals. And so when I can tell that someone is a seasoned traveler, I observe their rituals.
Uh-oh.
And the ritual, they were good rituals, actually. You took your shoes off, and you put a pillow on the ground, and you put your feet on the pillow.
I don't have very long legs, yeah.
But it was comfortable. Like, I'd never thought to do that before, just put my feet on a pillow. And then you had an iPad and you played Scrabble.
maybe. Or I'm trying to think maybe I was doing something cooler, but probably not.
What are some other rituals that you have when you're traveling? I'm always trying to streamline the process because it's a lot.
One is, I realized this a while ago, almost anything I need traveling, I can buy when I get to the place where I'm going. Right. So it amazes me, like friends of mine will travel and they'll bring dental floss. And I'm like, you know, you could get dental floss in Cleveland.
They have it.
You know, like it's not like we're hunter-gatherers and we need to bring everything with us. You know, like nomads going across the Sahara, and if we're not prepared, we die. Mm-hmm. Like you're flying from, Newark to Chicago. Everything they have in Newark, they have in Chicago. So now I just don't bring that much stuff with me. And I think like, oh, if I need toothpaste, I can probably get toothpaste there.
Well, a lot of hotels also will just give you toothpaste.
Yeah. And socks. And like, I mean, literally I have friends who will spend like the night before they leave, like making sure they have packed everything. It's like, I need my passport and I need credit cards. That's kind of about it. Like a laptop is nice.
Yep.
And something to eat on the plane. That's pretty much all I bring with me.
I always buy food in the terminal and bring it on the plane. I always buy food in the terminal and bring it on
the
plane.
Well, what I do now, and this is also like such a sort of like LA vegan new age cliche, when I'm driving to the airport, I stop at Cafe Gratitude and get veggie burgers.
Mm-hmm. What do you have to say when you get those? I am.
Do I really have to say it? Okay, the veggie burgers are called magical.
I am magical.
So, yeah, so I do have to say I am
magical. At least they could help you out and name it something else. You're like,
Do you want to know the question of the day? Nope.
Yeah. But I like being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Like it's good for me. So I get my little I am magicals. Yeah. And I bring them on the plane. So that, and I think there's also some, like a little dessert that they make that I really like.
Yeah.
I forget
what. There's great.
Yeah.
I'm not really, my girlfriend's vegetarian. And so just sort of by default, I eat a lot of vegetarian stuff, which I'm totally happy to do. There's a lot of really great places in Los Angeles, but I know that it's a pain in the ass enough to travel to, especially to a lot of the towns that I go to in the middle of the country, you know, to be vegetarian, but to be vegan, the places that you must go, how do you work around?
It's gotten a lot easier. When I first started touring in the late 80s, early 90s, then it was challenging. Like going to the Ukraine in 1992 and trying to find vegan food, like it just literally, unless you were like in a field digging up beets, it didn't exist.
You're just eating Oreos.
Yeah. And now it's so easy. Like there are Whole Foods everywhere. There's this website, Happy Cow, that lists all the vegetarian vegan places within a city.
Oh, that's good.
And so I have become sort of like an accidental hunter-gatherer. So I go to a city and I already have my list of places I want to try.
Oh, nice.
Still airports are challenging.
They're the worst.
Yeah, yeah. San Francisco's got a vegan place.
Yeah.
Other terminals.
I had breakfast there once and I was like, I couldn't believe I was having like nice organic vegan food in an airport. Like I just wanted to keep buying things even though I wasn't hungry just to make sure that they wouldn't go out of business.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's some, where was I? Oh, I was just in a, where? Oh, this is a question. You might know this because Wayne was on the Innocence album. What's the city that the Flaming Lips are from?
Oh, it's Oklahoma.
Oklahoma City.
Is it Oklahoma City?
I think so. Not Tulsa.
No, it's Oklahoma City.
Oklahoma City.
That's where Flaming Lips Alley is, next to the Banjo Museum.
Yeah, so they're in there. Like, they're etching a window. Like, the Flaming Lips are etching a window at the airport. But I found that to be a pretty nice airport. Minneapolis has a pretty nice airport. St. Louis has a good airport. Denver's got a great airport.
You have to walk a mile if you want to transfer planes in Minneapolis.
This is like a good like conversation to have, say, in like 40 years.
Yeah.
We'll be like, yeah, well, I like the Newark airport. The only problem is, you know, like, what with my gout?
Yeah.
Takes me a little while. I'm like, I had a transfer. See, I was flying through to Raleigh, Durham.
This old timer isn't teleport. Hey. He's still got to get on airplanes. Oh, my God. The traveling, I really did have to get over. Because I used to hate it, and that was a situation where I really did have to find joy in something because I knew like this is going to be a part of my life all the time.
Here's another thing that I love: airport fiction. Because when I first started touring, I was a pretentious former philosophy major.
Sure.
And I was like, oh, I'm going to bring Schopenhauer and this light with me.
Some light reading.
And I'd fall asleep. And I was like, well, I'll bring Schopenhauer and Kant and trashy airport fiction. And when I realized the Schopenhauer and the Kant never got opened, and the trashy airport fiction I devoured like Oprah after a fest. And so I developed this weird love for mass market airport fiction. So now when I travel, that's my little treat, is I get to read like a Lee Child book or a Harlan Coben book, like these authors, and they're so much fun.
Wow.
You don't really remember them when you're done with them, but they're great. And they'll last you, like if you're on an 8-hour flight, the book lasts you exactly as long as the flight is.
And what's one of your particular favorites?
In terms of authors, well, Lee Child is great. I mean, but even the New York Times gives him good reviews. Harlan Coben. And then some of the more serious guys like Michael Connelly. He's an L.A.-based writer. This guy John Connelly from Maine. They're all pretty good.
I'm on a lot of lists, so I get these weird sort of trashy sci-fi fiction books. So it's basically airport fiction, but then there are witches and...
There's a lot of that. That's a subgenre.
Vampires and werewolves and stuff.
Some of those are good. Some of those... I mean, like, clearly, like... You know, some author in a studio apartment in suburban Boston sees the success of Twilight, and they're like, "Oh, I want to do the same thing, but with werewolves." Or
this was an office romance, and I just made them witches.
Yeah.
So there you go.
I get autobiographies as my plain read. I always I'll read anyone's autobiography.
Any good ones?
Very readable. I did the last one I read was Still Fooling Them, the Billy Crystal one.
Did you read The Dirt, the Motley Crue one?
I did a long time ago when it came out.
See, I read that when I was still drinking a lot, and it made me feel so inadequate. I read it, I was like, I've never, like I'm such a pussy compared to these guys.
Yeah.
They were overachieving boozers.
And I mean, how, like, one day in Motley Crue at the height of their success literally would have killed me.
But I also like how they say, though, they say, like, we partied more than probably any other band. When we were hanging out with Ozzy Osbourne, he partied more than any of us combined.
But Ozzy, you can sort of tell he did that. Yeah. But the Motley Crue guys, like, they're all relatively coherent. They seem to be doing sort of okay.
But that's really interesting to me because you just the height of the electronic music movement that butted up against glam metal.
Mm-hmm.
Was the diametrical opposite presentationally. It was all about, I mean, like, they were all about the lifestyle and the party and the big fucking hair and the big, it was very visual. And then I remember going to see, when I think about it, it was actually kind of funny to go see a DJ perform because it's really just
it's absurd.
It's just a guy and I mean, although, you know, some guys like you would see, like, I think I mentioned DJ Dan earlier. I mean, the guy would spin, like, numerous turntables, and so there was a bit of an, like, oh, that's kind of cool that he's doing that. Yeah. But in general, it's very, you're watching someone present a very internal thing.
Well, I mean, when I go on tour, sometimes I play live, and if people watch me play live, I sort of understand it because I'm doing a lot. But then I DJ and people watch, and I'm like, I'm not really doing that much.
Yeah. There was that moment in 24-Hour Party People where just like he comes to the realization that like all these people are here and they're just watching a guy play records.
Yeah,
and he's like, oh, this is a thing.
Yeah, so I do sort of. I mean, what's nice though with the way the technology is now, that there is a lot of stuff you can do, like in terms of processing and looping and whatever. But I mainly do it just to entertain myself. Because otherwise you stand there and play a record and feel like a dick.
Yeah.
But so you're saying about like hair metal degeneracy, rave culture degeneracy, indie rock degeneracy, like they all do have like their drug of choice, their approach to degeneracy. But I'm imagining like a Venn diagram and where they all meet is substance abuse.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, so that's the common denominator. It's like, so I had a night out once with Tommy Lee and Dimebag Darrell from Pantera.
Whoa.
And we got along great because we were all just getting drunk and doing drugs. And so that was
is there a picture from that night of the three of you hanging out?
I think so.
That's going to be like that picture of like Pee Wee Herman, David Lee Roth, and fucking Rodney hanging out. There's a picture of the three of them hanging out. I want to see a picture of that night.
I think it might be, there's a Pantera video. And they were documenting it. But the night ended at Pantera Strip Club in Dallas.
Oh, fuck.
And at like 5 o'clock in the morning, Daryl and Tommy Lee and I decided we were going to start a band together. And of course, this was just like a liquor and cocaine fueled idea, but it would have been...
That would have been crazy. Yeah. Was the strip club called Cowgirls from Hell?
It should have been. I think it's called like The Clubhouse.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm. That was...
Vulgar display of prowess. Sorry.
Yeah, vulgar display of pasties. Yeah. But yeah, so I know what you're saying. Like, you would think that like these worlds wouldn't collide at all, but they did collide when it came to like liquor and drugs.
That's really, and I guess, you know, each of those genres of music is really kind of an expression of the drug that fuels it, right? Like Motley Crue, fucking cocaine, and like, yeah, let's fucking party, you know? And then rave culture, which is just what I perceive to be rave culture is just, you know, the booze and the ecstasy, and you're just standing there by yourself, just vibrating and feeling really good.
Yeah,
and then
throwing
like
shapes.
And then, and then, you know, grunge and heroin and that, you know, that kind of, I mean, it really is kind of an interesting, they all sort of, I never really thought about it. It was just all sort of expressions of the drugs that...
Then Pantera gets speed.
And also, well, they loved Crown Royal. That was their drug of choice.
So did my dad.
Yeah. So I remember going out with them, and like that was like you had to drink. There was like the communal Crown Royal bottle. Wow. Everyone drank Crown Royal. I'd never liked brown liquor that much because it was like cough syrup and the hangovers.
Yeah, it's the worst. Ooh.
Red wine and brown liquor, like that's the worst hangovers. But... I got distracted by substance abuse.
You were talking about Dimebag Darrell and Tommy Lee, and you were going to form a band.
But then what was also been really surprising, like I remember one of the first raves I ever played in Los Angeles, one of the guys from ZZ Top came backstage. And I was on tour with The Prodigy and Richie Houghton. And we were all backstage, and suddenly one of the ZZ Top guys shows up backstage, and none of us had ever met a famous person. And we were so nervous, but in the back of our minds, we were all thinking like, Does he know what we do? And he was fascinated with electronic music. So I think what I found over the years is like so many rock guys are fascinated with electronic music. And a lot of people in the world of electronic music, like myself or Skrillex, come from the sort of like punk rock background. Yeah. So there is a lot of surprising sort of like inter-genre overlap.
Yeah, because I guess it's easy to think of people in terms of being of these one-dimensional entities. But at the core of it, you go, no, they're artists and they're, you know, like they picked a thing that they liked, but that doesn't mean that they don't draw from other sources or are kind of go, hey, what's happening in that yard over there? I mean, that's not, I guess it really does sort of, to hear all that doesn't, you know, when you really think of it, it's not really that surprising that you guys all essentially do the same thing. It just expressed in different ways.
Yep. Yeah. So I have a question for you guys, and I don't know if you can answer honestly.
Sure.
I was going to ask two questions. Two parts of the same question. What guests have you had who've been terrible and who's been good?
No one's been, there's only been one guest that was kind of difficult to navigate, not really so much through his own fault. And we've talked about this on the podcast before, but Harrison Ford was kind of, tough to navigate.
Well, I remember seeing him being interviewed on David Letterman a while ago, and his shtick was that he didn't say anything. Like, he was so uncomfortable being interviewed. Yeah. And David Letterman kept ridiculing him for this.
Yeah. Well, he's funny on Conan. He's on Conan because Conan will make him kind of goof off, and that's what we were hoping for.
I thought it was I crumbled, which I'm not really prone to doing just because I've done this a lot, but it just... You know, I freaked out because it was him, and I just got starstruck because he's so buried deep in my... The only other time I got that starstruck was like working with the Muppets, you know, or I'm like, you know, like when something that's that buried in your childhood.
Two bits of Muppet trivia.
Yes.
One, I met Jim Henson right before he died.
Oh.
I think, or soon before he died, in Westchester County, New York. My then girlfriend and I went to a party, and of course I was very, very drunk, and I didn't know where we were. And it turns out we were in Jim Henson's house. So at like 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm drunk in the kitchen and I look up and Jim Henson is standing there. And I was just like, what? How is this even possible? Like, we're in a weird suburban house in Westchester, New York. And it turns out he was the dad of the guy having the party.
Oh, wow.
Brian?
I think so.
Brian Henson?
Maybe.
That's amazing.
So that's my accidental Jim Henson story. The other is I have some friends who work on the Muppets in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope I'm not getting anyone in trouble. It is a rite of passage to have sex in Snuffleupagus.
Yeah. I think you just got everybody in trouble.
That is not where I thought that was going.
Yeah. Apparently, it's like when they have their holiday party, people have sex in Snuffleupagus.
Allegedly.
Yeah.
Hey, bird. Yeah. Well, you know, because if you're having sex, no one can see it.
Yeah, that's it. And big enough,
people,
like...
two people can fit in.
Yeah.
Yep. So, okay, so Harrison Ford was awkward.
New goal, and the goal is to have sex inside Harrison Ford. If you can have sex inside Harrison Ford. And it turned out, you know, when I say it wasn't really entirely his fault, he does this character of the cranky guy, but he's also kind of the cranky guy, but he thinks the uncomfortable moments are really fun. Like, he really likes the uncomfortable... So, like what you saw on Letterman... Part of that might have been him being uncomfortable with himself, but I think he also relishes, like, he just kind of likes that. He sort of feeds off those uncomfortable moments.
Charles Grodin was so much better at that on talk shows.
Though. Well, Charles Grodin's has a comedy.
Yeah.
And he also was, he would do that sigh.
Yeah.
You know, the world is too much for him and everyone's dumber than he is.
Yeah.
So in the end, it turned out that the episode, I thought the episode was a complete disaster, and I was devastated for a long time, and I didn't even want to put it out, but I knew, like, I got to put it out. It's Harrison
Ford. You should use sound effects, like just like crickets, donkey sounds.
Your brain would fill those in, but it actually, in the end, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. Like, it was actually okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful for the experience because it taught me... I thought I had done this so much that I, you know, like, how many great lessons am I really going to... I mean, you always kind of learn some, but I always felt like, yeah, I kind of got this figured out. But it really taught me how to not be afraid of the person that I'm talking to. Because once you're afraid, and, you know, like, if you're a performer, once you're afraid on stage...
It's like being a circus trainer.
Yeah. Once the animals smell that you're afraid, it's over. Because they're not going to respect you. And
then
they don't...
it's like Siegfried and Roy.
Yeah. Then Harrison Ford chomps on your neck and takes you off stage. And you're like, but he was trying to protect me. And they're like, no, he wanted to eat your face.
Yeah.
So Harrison Ford was really the only difficult one. And I fault myself for a lot of that, for just nerding out too much. But in general, everyone's been really cool. In almost 500 episodes.
500?
Almost 500.
So in this little room?
Not all in this room.
So 500 people.
But there's some really amazing... Yeah, like,
that's a lot of people.
There are people that are amazing and you know they're going to be amazing, like Tom Hanks. But then there are other people like Paul Williams.
Oh, Paul Williams.
Where you
don't even get me started on Paul Williams. I'm such a huge Paul Williams fan. He wrote The Rainbow Connection.
He wrote Rainbow Connection, and he told an amazing story about when
having
they were...
sex and Snuffleupagus.
They had sex and Snuffleupagus. And then... But it just... how they were writing Rainbow Connection, and they had everything but the lyrical hook of the song. And so, you know, he and Jim Henson, they were there, and it's in I guess in they were trying to work they were working on it, and you know, it's and his I guess Paul's girlfriend or someone came in, and he was like, oh, we're almost there. It's just like, we're trying to find this. Someday we'll find it. And he was like, we're just trying to find like a connection to a rainbow, but we don't know what it is. And she was like, Rainbow Connection? Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh my God. Yeah. But he,
that's,
you know,
like any of those movies about musicians.
And then they did,
say that one more time.
And then they did a few more lines of coke.
And then they found it.
And then they got in Snuffleupagus.
Then they found the Rainbow Connection inside Snuffleupagus. Yeah. But you know, having people like that on that I definitely respect, but I don't know what to expect, and then finding out they're amazing people, those are the ones that I really like flip out over.
And so I have another question. How do I ask this? Okay, has anyone farted in here during an interview? Because it seems like it's such a small enclosed space. I mean, granted, I know again, podcasts are not a visual medium, but there's like an air filter
thing
over there, but like. Okay, so one time I was going to an award show, something or other, and I was with my girlfriend at the time and my manager, and it was freezing cold in New York City, and we were in a car service, and I farted a little bit. And it was one of those ones where you're like, no one's going to notice, but it was horrible. Like as if someone had like taken like a bag of rotten lobsters, hid it behind a radiator for like a month, and then... like emptied it out at low tide. Like it was just terrible, 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 terrible. And clearly everyone knew what had happened, but it was like 5 degrees outside, so we couldn't put the windows down.
So you just had to ride it out.
So I sat there like, oh.
Steve Jones from the...
Steve Jones was fucking great.
But he farted.
Oh, he did fart.
Yeah, yeah. It was lava proud. It didn't smell.
Yeah.
But it's charming when he does it.
Yeah.
Everything he does is charming.
Just to, like, hit on a girl and fart at the same time.
Yeah.
Because he's Steve Jones.
We also just had Thomas Dolby on, who was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Didn't fart.
Did not fart. But he was fantastic.
Because in here, like, you couldn't get away with, like, if you're doing, like, if you're on, like, a TV set where there's, like, a lot of square footage and you farted, like, oh, it would dissipate. Like, you know.
Yeah, but here.
One of those laws of thermodynamics, like, gas rapidly expands to
we're gonna
space.
It'll happen, but then no one's going to know. Then there's that weird thing of, like, do you acknowledge it or do you let it go?
You say it's Kyle.
Yeah, it's my job.
But I think that we've evolved on some sort of, like, olfactory level. Like, we know who farted. Like, there's no doubt. Like, it's like, even if you don't know, you can't, like, pinpoint, you're like something. Like, you look, you're like, oh, it was that person.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, you, it's just disgusting. Like, you smell their DNA encoded in the fart.
And there's also a little bit of a fart Doppler.
Yeah.
Where you can sort of sense it's coming from that general direction. So then we would know it was Katie.
Yeah, we instantly understand.
Way to go, Katie.
Yeah, when in doubt, blame Katie.
No one did it here. I'm looking up, Who else? Oh, John Lithgow was fucking phenomenal. I mean, that one was sort of expected, though. He was pretty great. And, you know, no one has been really
out of 500 people, because you would think. I mean, because public figures generally are like equal parts like insecure and narcissistic.
Yeah,
and generally a lot of public figures I find are not very good at dealing with themselves in a lighthearted manner. Like
Here's what we found, though, is that since it's not a short-form interview, we have a long runway.
Oh, this is like the Hugo Chavez speech of interview. You know, like.
We have a lot of runway to really get into a conversation with people. And the podcast, this format to me is sort of like, it's like a coffee chat that you have with someone that you've just met that you find interesting and you want to learn more about them. And I think when people come on, they and even if they're a little defensive in the beginning, they understand that we're nice. And I've done enough bad interviews in my career to be very sensitive to make sure that it feels more like a conversation and that people aren't threatened and that it's kind of a safe zone to chat.
Yeah.
And I think everyone kind of senses that and they kind of just let the guard down and go, okay. And then, you know, and once you start talking about things that people are interested in, they open up, you know, instead of the same, like, what was it like to be in this or play that thing? And then you have your stock answers,
and who have been some of the really intimidating ones? Like, if you had Werner Herzog
that would be intense.
Can I tell you a Werner Herzog
story? Please.
Okay. So I got invited, and I'm not supposed to talk about it, but I got invited to this event, and Neil Armstrong spoke, and it was the most amazing thing. He was speaking. We're outside, and he was talking about space. And when he started talking about the moon appeared behind him over the horizon. Like, it came up just over the horizon, a full moon, like it was like his lost dog hearing the master's voice.
Buddy.
Yeah. So that was amazing. But then we're having dinner, and Werner Herzog was there. Oh, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but it was really amazing. So he's there with his, like, amazing wife, who's like a 35-year-old Russian philosopher. And she doesn't say anything. So all through dinner, we're just sitting, talking. She's completely quiet. And somehow the conversation goes towards, everyone's talking about what to do if you're attacked. Like, what to do, you know, some talking about being attacked and like, oh, well, you run or you kick or you do something. And then Werner Herzog's wife, who hasn't said anything for hours, out of nowhere says, if you're attacked, menstruate everywhere.
Oh, God.
And there's this pause, and we all kind of look at her, and she just sits back and doesn't say anything.
At will?
And that was the only thing that she said. Like, so when you're attacked, menstruate everywhere.
I love that she can do that on command.
Yeah. Speeds up time.
Hang on.
Have you seen the fake Werner Herzog doing Curious George?
No. Was that Paul F. Tompkins said that?
I don't know who did it, but it's on the internet machine.
Yep.
And if you just Google Werner Herzog Curious George, it's why they invented the internet. It's someone doing a perfect Werner Herzog voice doing their interpretation of Curious George.
Oh, man.
Like, this is what happens when you take an instrument of chaos out of the primordial jungle. Yeah, that's it.
This is George. He lived in an obscene, overwhelming jungle where murder is the norm, and also he could not help
rabbit, he was a murderer too. Still, he was a good little monkey and always very curious. One day, an intruder from society appeared in the jungle. What a nice little monkey, he thought. I would like to take him home with me. He put his hat on the ground, and George is lured out of hiding by the hat. An alien trinket of unimaginable
culture. I don't think that's Paul.
So I don't know who made it. It's up there with you. And you saw like the G.I. Joe infomercials, right?
Yes.
Wait,
yes,
the,
yes.
The old G.I. Joe.
G.I. You've never seen
the fake film ones?
The fake ones?
No, no, but like the
body,
guy Fensler.
Body massage.
Body massage machine.
Yeah, those are like classic internet.
That's
like,
pre-YouTube
stuff. I'm just saying, like, but these are things that might have, like, you might have missed over the years.
I love that stuff. That guy ended up working, I think, like on Tom Goes to the Mayor and stuff like that.
Well,
and speaking of the internet machine, what about another old meme from a few years ago, the fake guitar solos?
Oh, the best. Like the Eddie Van Halen.
Because first couple times I saw it, I was like, is this real? Because he had done such a good job. I think it was Carlos Santana, and it was so bad. Like, just so uncomfortable, but not glaringly, obviously bad, just bad.
Just, like, artistically terrible.
And the subtle, the restraint involved in that. Really... The internet has made all our lives so much better.
So just to wrap things up and to answer your previous question.
So we have brain architecture.
We had brain architecture. We had – did you ever work with Prince since you came around?
Okay, no. One of my dreams in terms of collaborating, because I've worked with a lot of my heroes, but I really want to make an album with Prince that's nothing but like slow romantic music.
Oh, that'd be great.
Like, I like his up-tempo stuff. It's fine, but it's the songs like off Purple Rain, like the slow
romantic beautiful ones.
Yeah. The beautiful ones. Oh.
It's a fucking amazing song.
And even Purple Rain, like his ballads are so good. And I just wish he'd do more of them. So I really want to make like an old sounding like R&B romantic slow record with Prince.
That would be amazing. So I was a little intimidated by Neil Gaiman, who turned out to be wonderful. I was intimidated by Oliver Stone because I just didn't know how he was going to come at me, but that turned out fine.
Yeah.
I was very nervous about you, actually, because I've never really seen you speak a lot, so I didn't know what to expect. Hmm. But
it's been a huge disappointment.
It's been fucking fantastic. Hmm. It's been fantastic. And I feel like I don't know. I feel like we talked about a lot of stuff that you know maybe most people don't know. Most people don't know about you. Is it? You've done a million and a half interviews mm-hmm. and chats and stuff. What is it? What is your experience like with this sort of thing?
My experience is that one of the biggest variables is I'm all in favor of people not speaking English, but it makes doing an interview really challenging if you're talking to someone who doesn't speak English.
Or
sometimes you'll be in. I don't know, let's say France, and you'll meet a French journalist who speaks enough English to sort of phrase a question.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like if you've ever dated someone where English isn't their first language, like there's never that comfortable language, like shared familiarity.
Yeah, you can't go too fast.
Yeah, and you can't just blah, 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 blah. You can't make, you know, there's no frame of reference. That is for me one of the hardest things about doing interviews is when you're doing like press in a hotel room in a place where they don't speak English. And again, if I'm in France, they shouldn't speak English because it's France. And I should speak French, but it makes it very awkward. But when you have like people who clearly like grew up listening to the same records in roughly the same places, even though like Connecticut and Honolulu are pretty far away from each other.
Yeah.
It's like
we still saw Ray Capo perform.
Yeah. Actually, Ray, so because Ray's from Connecticut.
Yeah.
So he was in Youth of Today.
Yes.
But originally he was in a band called Violent Children. When I was in this band Vatican Commandos.
Yeah.
And we all played a show together at a prep school, Choate Rosemary Hall in Connecticut.
Wow.
But the person who was booking the show, we had to all change our names because like I was in Vatican Commandos, they were Violent Children, there was this other band, Reflex from Pain. So we all had to come up with like gentle names. So Reflex from Pain became Reflections of Poetry.
Wow.
Violent Children, I think, became like Victorious Children.
Yeah.
So that was one of my first experiences with Ray in 1981 or 82 because I'm very old.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I see him all the time because now he teaches yoga and he's a vegan and he's
him and Porcel. They both like do yoga stuff now. Yeah, they, Ray Capo came to Hawaii to play with Better Than a Thousand, which was this kind of revival band, 80s hardcore revival band. And then the show got canceled. Then I just had to show him around Hawaii, and then heard him complain about the band Lifetime.
That's not very enlightened of him.
No. Yeah.
Well, do you, as we're kind of wrapping this up, because so we can let you go. I just got the sign that we have to wrap you. Does he need to, I guess you have places to, would you have places to be other than just sitting in a comic book store all day?
I've got Facebook to check.
You have Facebook to, do you have all your profiles?
Yeah.
Do you feel like, because you sort of, you know, you sort of self-deprecatingly said, oh, I'm an asshole inside. Do you still believe that, or do you feel like you overcame that, or do you feel like you grapple with it, or how did you?
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky. I do think that, I mean, if I look back at my behavior, like, even if I've had good intentions, I've been kind of an asshole at times. You know, sort of opinionated, contentious, cranky. But then there's that question we were talking about earlier. It's like, where does it come from? You know, and like, I have some friends who just sort of like self-identify as assholes. You know, they're like, that's who they are. That's their character.
And that makes it okay.
And they're not willing to sort of like maybe look and to see like how it's a defense mechanism for something else. Whereas me, like when if I'm being like a really argumentative, angry douchebag, I have to take a step back and say like, okay, where is this coming from? You know, and again, not to be all self-involved and therapized, but it certainly makes friendships and relationships a lot easier when I'm not just being argumentative and cranky all the time.
Yeah. Well, that's excellent. I think that's a nice dismount on the podcast, and people should go to Innocence is out.
Sure.
On Little Idiot Records.
Well, so in 1991 or 92, I was going to do a TV show with my manager. He wasn't going to be on the TV show.
Okay.
And it was a really tacky TV show, like some like Dance Fever type show. But I was such a media slut, like I would just do anything. And he's German and laconic and very funny. And he looked at me and he was like, well, if you are going to be a little idiot and just do everything that's offered to you. And I just started laughing and laughing. And I was like, so henceforth, all my professional, like my publishing company, it's all called Little Idiot. Because that's awesome. Me. I'm little and I'm not very smart.
People can also go to MobyLosAngelesArchitecture.com to look at your architecture blog.
Oh, and then I have a weird website called MobyGratis.com where I give free music away to indie filmmakers and film students and nonprofits.
That's awesome.
And then I just did something with BitTorrent where I took all the stems from the most recent album, Innocence, and gave those away for free.
Nice.
It's like anyone can. Wow. It's, my goal professionally is to be as stupid and make as little money as possible.
Or is it just to get your stuff out as much as possible?
It's that weird, fantastic, democratic chaos of the internet where like you make something, you put it out into the world and you have no idea what's going to happen. Like it might be ignored, it might be embraced, but like the least interesting thing is to try and like control it and monetize it. You know, so I feel like it's just more interesting. Like, make something you love, put it out there.
See what happens.
Have no idea. No. Make no effort to control it whatsoever.
That's very hard to do. I mean, emotionally, that's hard for a lot of people.
I guess it's not to keep rambling on. I know you guys are like, the one interviewee who like wouldn't leave.
No, we're just being respectful of your time. If you want to talk, you can talk.
But watching other people make mistakes. Something like, for example, like one thing that helps me stay sober is going to bars at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Seeing drunk people, yeah.
So when I see like sloppy drunk people, I'm like, oh, that was me for a couple of decades, and it's awful. But when I see musicians desperately trying to control the way their music is like heard or distributed or sold, it just, the more they try and control it, the more distasteful it seems to me. And so I'm just like, oh, okay, so clearly I shouldn't be trying to do that. Like, it's so much more interesting if you just sort of embrace the weird chaotic status quo of the internet and just sort of, you know, let things be chaotic.
Yeah, that's why I like that Bandcamp site, bandcamp.com, where it's like bands could just upload it and it has all the interface to be able to just pay whatever you want or just take it for free.
Yeah, I love that, like, appeal to people's best nature. And like, you want it for free. Like, I'd much rather have someone listen to my music and not pay for it than be prevented from listening to it by not being able to pay for it.
Yeah, free podcasts.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. We want more people to hear and hopefully enjoy it rather than like, I'm going to make a couple bucks.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, we should probably make a couple bucks.
Yeah. I think we're good.
We're good.
We could raise the ceiling. Got the quilt on the wall.
Yeah, that quilt's pretty. I mean,
that's a.
That costs something.
Man hours. Enjoy your burrito, everybody. And scene.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.